This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I would like vaccine development to happen as quick as possible. And for that to happen, there have to be people who are willing to be part of these challenge trials, it seems. And if that's the case, then, you know, I don't see any good reason why it shouldn't be me.
This is A.B. Rorick. He's 20 years old, an undergraduate, and he's got some news to break to his mother, Elaine.
I know I've talked to you a bit about my involvement with human challenge trials, or at least my desired involvement with human challenge trials to help speed up the development of a vaccine for coronavirus. And that's basically why I want to talk to you, is that I would like to volunteer myself to be part of this trial should it happen.
I'm pretty floored by that. But I think that it just seems like that's a huge risk to take, especially with just one kidney.
Larissa McFarker is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Larissa, you talked recently to A.B. Rorick. What's going on here?
A.B. has volunteered to be a subject in a vaccine trial, a particular kind of high-risk experiment called a human challenge trial. And his mother is pretty worried about it.
I totally admire and respect your desire to help people. I just don't know how safe it is.
Right.
But you just had your kidney out in July. I can't imagine that would be safe. I mean,
but basically, I want to put my name down. And if a trial comes about and experts deem that I am fit actually to be part of a human challenge trial, then I want to do it.
Wow. I follow you. And I understand that you want to help. And that's the way you've always been. But it's,
I think I feel a sort of broader sense of obligation, or almost like a principled obligation, that I know that there need to be people who are willing to step up. And I just feel this urge to be one of those people. Or framed the other way, I guess, you know, why shouldn't it be me? I guess having one kidney is a pretty good reason.
Yeah, because it's like you're doing this for the universe, but you are my universe. So, you know, it's a little bit hard to... Yeah, I guess I just need to know more, you know, who's doing the testing, how much COVID are they exposing you to? And are there any other people who volunteered besides you?
Yeah. There are 16,000 people, over 16,000 people now who have volunteered.
It's more than there were people in my hometown of Carlisle. So that's a good sign.
I've got a lot of questions, Larissa, but first explain what a human challenge trial is.
Yeah, so normally what you do in a vaccine trial is you give the vaccine candidate to several thousand people, you give several thousand others a placebo, and then everybody goes home, they go about their regular lives. And after several months, you see who's gotten the disease, who hasn't, and that tells you something about how effective the vaccine is. Well, just that phase alone takes many months, because what you're doing is you're just sending people around about their daily lives, and so they might not get it. And what's worse, people are not going about their regular lives, right? They're staying at home, they're practicing social distancing, they're doing everything they possibly can to avoid getting sick. So if you were to follow the normal vaccine protocol and send people out to see if they get it or not, it could be much longer than that. They might not get it, and it might tell you nothing about the vaccine candidate at all.
Right.
In a human challenge trial, you give volunteers a vaccine candidate, and then you expose them to the virus on purpose. That way, you can start to get a sense of whether the vaccine candidate works or not within a couple of weeks.
So who's signing up for that? I mean, that sounds awfully dangerous to be deliberately exposed to
Yes. The
novel coronavirus.
It is, of course. You know, to be clear, this is all still hypothetical. There are no human challenge trials happening right now in the U.S. Trials, they would need to be approved by the FDA. But yes, AB is volunteering to get COVID.
Well, I can understand wanting to make things faster, but that, you know, it just seems like certain people react to COVID in ways that are very quickly deadly, right? So I just know the Tuskegee syphilis experience. Like, there are bad cases of people being harmed by in these trials. So, you know, I don't know, but this one, it just somehow seems a bit more dangerous than giving your kidney away.
No, I understand. And I think you very well might be right. You know, this is a question for the scientists and the doctors about whether or not having one kidney will seriously compromise me should I be should I get coronavirus? Should I be part of a trial?
So AB said to his mom that more than 16,000 people, including himself, have signed up to volunteer. But that was already several days ago. And I checked the number this morning. This morning, there were more than 23,000 people signed up to volunteer to be exposed to COVID, and in 102 countries. So this thing has become huge. Three researchers wrote a paper at the end of March, it was published, suggesting these human challenge trials. And a group of people were inspired by this idea and thought, well, how are we going to get people to sign up? They started an online sign-up sheet. This is a group called One Day Sooner. They're called One Day Sooner because they're estimating that each day that you cut off the process of developing a vaccine could save thousands of lives.
Wow. People volunteer to do risky things on behalf of others that are riskier than this, including kidney donations, all the time.
Professor Mark Lipsitch was one of the co-authors of the journal article in support of using challenge trials, so he's very much behind this idea.
The real reason I wanted to get this idea out there is that we really face a challenge that's very much worse than challenges we've faced before from infectious diseases. And it seems to me that even a very small benefit in terms of speeding up the approval or availability of a vaccine could be enormously valuable to humanity. If we really thought it was not acceptable for people to voluntarily take on risk on behalf of others, then we would have to shut down our police, fire, EMT, and military operations, because that's how we run them, is we ask people to take on risks which are not definable fully in advance. And they're doing that as a job, but also on behalf of other people. And research needs special protections because of the history of bad things that have happened under the guise of research. But I think it's important to see this as one of the many areas where people can take on an altruistic risk if that's something they choose to do.
I've been talking to a few people about these volunteers who are signing up, and I think most people's first reaction is that's insane. Like, why would you voluntarily expose yourself to coronavirus? But it actually doesn't seem that strange to me. I mean, it feels like this is a world historical moment, and this is, in a sense, the moral test that's held up for this generation. Are you gonna, you know, put yourself on the line to help us out of this crisis? And, you know,
well, let me ask you this question then, Larissa. Let's say you have a 20-year-old son or daughter.
I know.
How do you feel about your kid doing this?
Yeah, I asked Professor Lipsitch that same question.
If someone you were close to, someone in your family in the right age bracket wanted to be part of this trial, what would you say?
I would probably try to discourage them, to be honest.
Wow.
There's this old Jewish idea that people who want to become convert to Judaism should be discouraged three times before they do it by a rabbi. And I'm not religious, so this is not a literal translation. But I think that this is a decision that should be done really with a lot of reflection and with understanding that there is a risk that something bad will happen. So I would not say, "Oh yeah, go ahead. This is fine." I would discourage it because I think it is a risk. But I also think that people should have the ability, and even my own children, if they were old enough.
Larissa, you've said this is controversial, and there do seem to be a number of ways for this to go very badly for a volunteer. You know, and we're also unclear about the effect of the coronavirus on the young. And initially, we were told, well, this just doesn't affect children at all, doesn't affect young people. If you're healthy and under a certain age, you're going to be just fine. You might not even know you had it. And that's largely true. But now we see young people getting extremely sick, again, mm-hmm. not in the same numbers as somebody 65 and older and so on. We hear about all kinds of unexpected symptoms and difficulties with this. It complicates matters immensely, doesn't it?
Of course. And I talked to a scientist who sees the issue very differently, a virologist who's worked on Ebola and other diseases.
When a person is infected with a virus, your body responds to that infection. Sometimes that response can be protective and keep you from getting sick, get rid of the virus, and protect you. Sometimes that response can actually be harmful and make the disease worse. And I study the nature of those responses and how they contribute to one outcome or another.
Her name is Angela Rasmussen, and she's now studying the novel coronavirus.
We know so little about this virus other than that it can be lethal, that it's very difficult for a subject in one of these trials to give informed consent.
Tell me about Angela Rasmussen. What is her view here?
So she has a very different view from Professor Lipsitch. She does not believe that these human challenge trials are the way to go. Ethically, she feels that you can't really consent to be a volunteer in a trial where the risks are unknown.
So if you sign up to join the military during wartime, you do sign up with the understanding that perhaps you may be going into combat, you could potentially even get killed. But you also do have a very good understanding of what the risks are. And in terms of doing any kind of human trial, whether it's a drug trial or a vaccine trial, people need to give informed consent. And what informed consent means is that they really have to be informed of the risks. Many of the people that I have seen, very enthusiastically volunteer to be a subject in a human challenge trial seem to think that they are low risk. And while they acknowledge the possibility that there may be severe risks, they tend to focus on the fact that they don't have any pre-existing risk factors and they're relatively young and healthy. And I wonder how the people who have volunteered for these trials, how many of them truly think that they are going to actually potentially die from participating in it.
So Dr. Rasmussen disagrees with these human challenge trials on ethical grounds, but she also feels that these trials are not the way to go scientifically because, as we discussed before, you're going to want to have volunteers who are the absolute lowest risk population, very young, very healthy. But the people who need the vaccine the most are not like that at all. They're older people, people with diabetes or hypertension or people who suffer from obesity. They're a very, very different set of people.
Why does that matter for a vaccine? We're worried about side effects?
You're worried about side effects, but also, like, suppose a vaccine appears to work in this young, healthy population. It may not work remotely the same in this very different population.
One of the main reasons why you need to do much larger phase 3 clinical trials is to account for all of the diversity between different communities and groups of people. If we are looking at a small, relatively homogenous group of human challenge trial volunteers, it potentially might blind us to how other people outside of that homogenous group might be responding to the vaccine, and it might change their susceptibility.
I put the same question to Mark Lipsitch, who is advocating for human challenge trials.
It's important to realize that if we had a vaccine for young, healthy people, that vaccine would have enormous social value in terms of not only allowing some of those people to, or many of those people to go back to work because of their direct protection, but also in indirectly protecting those to whom they're exposed who might not have gotten the vaccine yet. So building herd immunity in the young, healthy population would be no small victory. It would be quite a large victory.
This is a really unusual situation, and most of the time people aren't like, let's shave off a couple months by doing human challenge trials for a vaccine. So that's unprecedented, but this is a great conversation to have. I mean, I think that this needs to be discussed by more scientists than just my colleagues that you mentioned before.
There are thousands and thousands of mostly young people who've signed up to volunteer to be in these human trials. If they're listening, I think they'll get a sense from you that you don't think it's a good idea. So what should they do? Is there anything they can do to help?
Absolutely. And that is, they can enroll as subjects in a standard vaccine trial. We need large groups of people to volunteer to be in a phase 3 vaccine trial. So if people are signing up to get infected with the virus, I suggest they sign up to just get the vaccine. it would certainly be safer to them, but they would still be making a tremendously important contribution to vaccine development.
Larissa, you wrote a book about altruism, and you've also written in the magazine about people who really put themselves and their health at risk, and they somehow diminish their own lives in order to help others, in very serious ways, too. Here's a 20-year-old who says this: all these unknown risks to me are worth it for the greater good. Now, is that youth talking, or is there more to it than that? Are people like AB somehow wired differently from the rest of us?
I definitely don't think it's just youth talking. When I was researching my book, I talked with people of all ages who were just as willing to risk themselves for their principles as AB is. And they weren't weeping martyrs either. They wanted to live that way. They didn't want to just be comfortable. What I think does tend to happen as people get older is that others become dependent on you, kids, older parents, and that can be a reason not to take risks yourself. The tricky thing is that this can be both a very good reason and a kind of moral alibi. Protecting your family is, of course, a very deep and essential human instinct, but it can also be an excuse not to care about anyone else. If I had a 20-year-old kid who wanted to volunteer to do this, I would be so proud of them. I would be terrified, and I don't know that I would have the strength not to try to talk them out of it, but sitting here knowing I don't have a 20-year-old, which is a much easier situation, I like to think that I would support them. I think it's an amazing thing to do.
Larissa McFarker is a staff writer, and she spoke with Mark Lipsitch, Angela Rasmussen, and A.B. Rorick, a volunteer. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There are things we don't know yet about the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. And as in any trial, the suspects are entitled to the presumption of innocence, but this much seems beyond question. Two white men, one armed with a shotgun, went in pursuit of a black man who was jogging. They later told police that they suspected him of some break-ins in the neighborhood. There was some type of interaction, and Travis McMichael shot and killed Ahmaud Arbery. But local prosecutors didn't see the shooting as a crime. They didn't arrest McMichael and his father, Greg, for more than 2 months. To understand the laws and the mindset that make such a thing possible, The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb turned last week to Ira P. Robbins. Robbins is a professor at the Law School of American University, and he's co-director of the Criminal Justice Practice and Policy Institute. Here's Jelani Cobb with Ira P. Robbins.
You know, Mr. Barnhill, the second prosecutor who later recused himself, wrote a letter to the police department, the local police department, saying it appears that there, and here he's referencing the McMichaels, their intent was to stop and hold this criminal suspect until law enforcement arrived. Under Georgia law, this is perfectly legal. Does the statute explicitly allow for pursuit, and under what circumstances?
Well, I'll answer that, but add another layer. So when the McMichaels were pursuing Mr. Arbery, thinking they had the right to make a citizen's arrest because they think that Mr. Arbery was committing a crime in that dwelling under construction, I guarantee you the McMichaels had no idea whether the crime being committed was a felony or a misdemeanor. In fact, in the police report, it says two crimes. It mentions two crimes. One is homicide, and the other is criminal trespass. Well, if it's criminal trespass, that's a misdemeanor. And in citizen's arrest law, the arrestors would have fewer rights. If it was a burglary that Mr. Arbery was committing, that would be a felony, and the citizen's arrest law would allow greater leeway to the citizens.
So, with that in mind, was it surprising to you that two prosecutors looked at the situation and concluded that it was a valid citizen's arrest?
That conclusion indicates to me either that they don't know anything about the law of citizens' arrest, or they are confusing citizens' arrest with self-defense and stand-your-ground laws.
Could you sort those things out for us?
Sure. So under the citizens' arrest law, basically a person can hold an offender or suspected offender until the police arrive. Basically, it's their job to operate as witnesses, not to be a substitute for the police, not to take the law into their own hands. You add to that, though, that not all suspected offenders are willing to be arrested. And if an altercation ensues, then it may be that the arrester and the suspect get into some situation involving use of force, and then we get into self-defense, which is a complicated area of the law, even without issues of stand your ground. Ordinary self-defense law has a duty to retreat, with certain exceptions. Mm-hmm. The stand your ground law in Georgia eliminates the duty to retreat. So this case, in my opinion, stands or falls on whether the initial citizen's arrest confrontation was proper in the first place.
So we've seen, you know, the stand your ground laws that really entered our consciousness around the case of Trayvon Martin, who was a teenager, 17 years old, who was shot by a neighborhood watchman by the name of George Zimmerman in Florida. And, you know, this kind of thing, I think this alerted the public to the fact that there were so many jurisdictions that had these laws. And now we're seeing a similar conversation beginning to take place around citizens' arrests and the Ahmaud Arbery case. Is there any connection in your mind behind why we see such inflammatory situations, specifically around the lines of race, with these doctrines?
Wonderful question. It seems to me what we're seeing here is a deadly combination of the law of citizens' arrest, flawed self-defense laws, particularly when we have a stand-your-ground doctrine, as we do in Georgia, and arguably racial profiling as well. It may be that when the McMichaels raised this idea of stand-your-ground and self-defense built on citizens' arrest, the whole thing is a pretext for what starts out as racial profiling. And I would argue that they should have stayed in the truck. I mean, we've seen the video. Greg McMichael was on the phone with the police, who arrived certainly within a minute or so, perhaps less than a minute, of the shooting. The role of a citizen in a citizen's arrest is to operate as a witness. It's not as if they had information that Mr. Arbery was escaping from a major felony, a bank robbery, a homicide, or even a burglary. There was no burglary here. If this was a burglary, perhaps there would have been a right to a citizen's arrest. But since this was only a criminal trespass, no such right. And if there is no such right to do a citizen's arrest here, then when Travis McMichael confronted Mr. Arbery and started the altercation, it seems to me that Travis McMichael was the initial aggressor and as such loses the right to self-defense.
Another thing that made this case stand out to me was that, you know, the offense that started the entire pursuit, at least according to the McMichaels, was his presence on the property or on the grounds of a house that was under construction. And, you know, just a few months ago, before the COVID lockdowns began, I was visiting friends in Atlanta and I went for a walk. There's lots of new construction in the neighborhood, and I saw a house that was under construction, and I thought, I wonder what the floor plan is for this place. And I didn't go inside, but I walked kind of up onto where the lawn would be and was looking around. I was like, oh, they're putting a staircase over here and a deck over there. And it was just a kind of interesting observation I made while walking through the neighborhood and continued walking. And the idea that that could be provocation for an armed pursuit was unnerving and shocking to me at the least.
I agree with you. And it seems to me that people don't know what the law is. Especially a law that doesn't get a lot of attention, like citizens' arrest law. So when somebody does something that even reasonable people might do, even if it might be a very minor crime like criminal trespass, going onto someone's property when you don't have a right to be there, that doesn't justify detaining someone, using force, unreasonable force, and causing a death. If that part of this whole situation falls, as I think it should, then any defense the McMichaels are raising, I think, would fall like a house of cards. The foundation, the citizen's arrest, is not a good foundation.
You've looked at lots of cases of citizens' arrests and attempted citizens' arrests. These laws have created lots of problems and lots of situations that seem to be on the face very difficult and troubling. Why do they stay on the books?
A lot of laws whose time has passed stay on the books only because the legislature has not gotten around to repealing them. Or they think, well, maybe it's got these laws have some purpose that we don't presently see. So let's just leave them on the books and hope for the best. But when you see abuses like this, when you see unreasonable use of deadly force, officials have to stand up and pay attention because the... If we don't do something about it after such an obvious abuse in this case, then we're going to see many more abuses in the future. We don't want citizens' arrest to become a pretext for an unfortunate end to situations that start with racial profiling. We want organized police forces where the members of the police force have been trained to deal with offenders. We don't want ordinary people to take the law into their own hands.
Ira P. Robbins is a law professor and co-director of the Criminal Justice Practice and Policy Institute at American University's Washington College of Law. He spoke with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Just looking at my screen, I feel like you can just see my whole life on my wall, which is kind of weird.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, I never turn my camera on.
Sometimes I'm oh, please don't judge me. I didn't clean, but I have to come to class.
After her students left the building in March, not to return for the rest of the school year, Petria May decided to make the best of it, and she changed the curriculum and gave her 10th grade class Albert Camus' 1947 novel, The Plague.
I actually really like it, The Plague, even though it's relevant in an almost to an almost scary degree. I find it much more enjoyable.
I agree. I wouldn't say that I would go and read this book for pleasure. I definitely would not. But I still think it's an important thing to read. It helps to feel like someone else would kind of understand what we're going through.
Camus' book describes an outbreak of plague in a coastal city in Algeria, which is then completely cordoned off and guarded. There's a doctor trying to treat the suffering, a criminal who profits on the black market, a priest, a journalist, all understanding and responding to the disaster in various ways.
I actually recommended it to my mom, kind of with like a challenge not to just line up the obvious similarities. I feel like you can say like, okay, yeah, like it's a plague, it's quarantine, it's, you know, the authorities are not being responsible. Like there's all these like obvious similarities, but I feel like there's also like so many deeper lessons about just like what it means to live in a state of fear and like what human reaction to change is.
Yeah. A character I feel like I've kind of latched onto is Rambert. I think his whole like him wanting to escape felt very relatable. Like definitely not like I'm not trying to go see my wife in France, but I do. There is this feeling of like, I don't belong here. Like this should not happen to me. And I guess him turning himself around and going, okay, so I'm going to help instead because I can't escape, has made it a little easier on me to just not feel so bad about how much I hate it.
I think what was interesting is towards the end of the book is how society begins to go about again. And it kind of made me think about questions like, what will happen when this whole pandemic is over? You know, like my mom works for transit and she sent me over to my grandma's because of the fact that, like, you know, she has to work and she didn't want to expose us to anything. Now is definitely a time where I get to just kind of sit back and realize just how much she's sacrificing just so she can see her children, like, you know, survive. So it kind of arises the question, are we actually going to take a step back and look at how we're going through our life?
Yeah, I mean, Camus was a philosopher. He wasn't a psychic. So I think at the end of the day, like what Maya was saying, it's better to use it as a glimpse into human nature rather than about how people are living through a plague. But then again, like if you have a good grasp and understanding of human nature, it will give you insight into how people will inevitably react to a virus or pandemics, whatever.
Students in a 10th grade English class at Beacon High School in New York. We heard Elena Rubinstein, Afkadori Souffrant, Tamara Figueroa, and Maya Renaud Levine. If your kids haven't set foot in school in a couple of months, if you haven't seen your workplace or maybe even put on your shoes, you might not notice that summer is officially, unofficially here as of Memorial Day. So we're going to close the show today with a story set over the course of a long Memorial Day afternoon. It was published in The New Yorker many years ago, but the boredom with being at home, the claustrophobic feeling of a teenage boy spending way too much time with his parents, it all feels pretty relevant to the moment. Here's Peter Cameron's Memorial Day, read by the actor Noah Galvin.
I am eating a grapefruit with a grapefruit spoon my mother bought last summer from a door-to-door salesman on a large three-wheeled bike. My mother and I were sitting on the front steps that day, and we watched him glide down the street, into our driveway, and up our front walk. He opened his case on the handlebars, and it was full of fruit appliances. Pineapple cores, melon ballers, watermelon cedars, orange juice squeezers, and grapefruit spoons. My mother bought four of the spoons, and the man peddled himself out of our lives. That was about a year ago. Since then, a lot has changed, I think, as I pry the grapefruit pulp away from the skin with the serrated edge of the spoon. Since then, my mother has remarried, my father has moved to California, and I have stopped talking. Actually, I talk quite a lot at school, but never at home. I have nothing to say to anyone here. Across the table from me, drinking postum, is my new stepfather. He wasn't here last year. I don't think he was anywhere last year. His name is Lonnie, and my mother met him at a Seth Speaks seminar. Seth is this guy without a body who speaks out of the mouth of this lady and tells you how to fix your life. Both Lonnie and my mother have fixed their lives. One day at a time, my mother says every morning, smiling at Lonnie and then, less happily, at me. Lonnie is only 13 years older than I am. He is 29, but looks about 14. When the three of us go out together, he is mistaken for my brother. "Listen to this," Lonnie says. Both Lonnie and my mother continue to talk to me, consult with me, and read things to me, in the hope that I will forget and speak. If gypsy moths continue to destroy trees at their present rate, North America will become a desert incapable of supporting any life by the year 4000. Lonnie has a morbid sense of humor and delights in macabre newspaper fillers. Because he knows I won't answer, he doesn't glance up at me. He continues to stare at his paper and says, "Wow, think of that." I look out the window. My mother is sitting in an inflated rubber boat in the swimming pool, scrubbing the fiberglass walls with a stiff brush and Mr. Clean. They get stained during the winter. She does this every Memorial Day. We always open the pool this weekend, and she always blows up the yellow boat, puts on her Yankees hat so her hair won't turn orange, and paddles around the edge of the pool, leaving a trail of suds. Last year, as she scrubbed, the diamond from her old engagement ring fell out and sank to the bottom of the pool. She was still married to my father, although they were planning to separate after a last family vacation in July. My mother shook the suds off her hand and raised it in front of her face, her fingers flat, as if she were admiring a new ring. "Oh, Stephen," she said, "I think I've lost my diamond." "What?" I said. I still talked then. "The diamond fell out of my ring. Look." I got up from the chair I was sitting on and kneeled beside the pool. She held out her hand, the way women do in old movies when they expect it to be kissed. I looked down at her ring, and she was right. The diamond was gone. The setting looked like an empty hand tightly grabbing nothing. "Do you see it?" she asked, looking down into the pool. Because we had just taken the cover off, the water was murky. "It must be down there," she said. "Maybe if you dove in?" She looked at me with a nice, pleading look on her face. I took off my shirt. I felt her looking at my chest. There's no hair on my chest, and every time my mother sees it, I know she checks to see if any has grown. I dove into the pool. The water was so cold, my head ached. I opened my eyes and swam quickly around the bottom of the pool. I felt like one of those Japanese pearl fishers. But I didn't see the diamond. I surfaced and swam to the side. "I don't see it," I said. "I can't see anything. Where's the mask?" "Oh, dear," my mother said. "Didn't we throw it away last year?" "I forget," I said. I got out of the pool and stood shivering in the sun. Suddenly, I got the idea that if I found the diamond, maybe my parents wouldn't separate. I know it sounds ridiculous, but at that moment, standing with my arms crossed over my thin chest, watching my mother begin to cry in her inflatable boat, at that moment, the diamond sitting on the bottom of the pool took on a larger meaning. And I thought that if it were replaced in the tiny clutching hand of my mother's ring, we might live happily ever after. So I had my father drive me downtown, and I bought another diving mask at the 5 and 10, and when we got home, I put it on, first spitting on the glass so it wouldn't fog, and dove into the water, and dove again and again, until I actually found the diamond, glittering in a mess of leaves and bloated inchworms at the bottom of the pool. I throw my grapefruit rind away and go outside and sit on the edge of the diving board with my feet in the water. My mother watches me for a second, probably deciding if it's worthwhile to say anything. Then she goes back to her scrubbing. Later, I'm sitting by the mailbox. Since I've stopped talking, I've written a lot of letters. I write to men in prison, and I answer personal ads, claiming to be whatever it is the placer desires. an elegant, educated young lady for afternoon pleasure, or a GBM. The mail from prison is the best. Long, long letters about nothing, since it seems nothing is done in prison. A lot of remembering, a lot of bizarre requests. Send me a shoehorn, send me an empty egg carton. Arts and crafts? Send me an electric toothbrush. I like writing letters to people I've never met. Lonnie is planting geraniums he bought this morning in front of the A&P when he did the grocery shopping. Lonnie is very good about doing his share. I am not about mine. Every night, I wait with delicious anticipation for my mother to tell me to take out the garbage. How many times do I have to tell you? Can't you just do it? Lonnie gets up and walks over to me, trowel in hand. He has on plaid Bermuda shorts and a Disney World t-shirt. If I talked, I'd ask him when he went to Disney World. But I can live without the information. Lonnie flips the trowel at me, and it slips like a knife into the ground a few inches from my leg. Bingo, Lonnie says. Scare you? I think when a person stops talking, people forget that he can still hear. Lonnie is always saying dumb things to me, things you'd only say to a deaf person or a baby. What a day, Lonnie says, as if to illustrate this point. He stretches out beside me, and I look at his long white legs. He has sneakers and white socks on. He never goes barefoot. He's too uptight to go barefoot. He would step on a piece of glass immediately. That's the kind of person Lonnie is. The Captain ice cream truck rolls lazily down our street. Lonnie stands up and reaches in his pocket. Would you like an ice pop? He asks me, looking at his change. I shake my head no. An ice pop? Where did he grow up? Kentucky? Lonnie walks into the street and flags down the ice cream man, as if it isn't obvious what he's standing there for. The truck slows down and the ice cream man jumps out. It's a woman. What can I get you? She says, opening the freezer on the side of the truck. It's the old-fashioned kind of truck, with the ice cream hidden in its frozen depths. I always thought you needed to have incredibly long arms to be a good Captain Ice Cream person. Well, I'd like a nice ice pop, Lonnie says. A twin bullet? Suggests the woman. What flavor? Do you have cherry? Lonnie asks. Sure, the woman says. Cherry, grape, orange, lemon, cola, and tutti frutti. For a second, I have a horrible feeling that Lonnie will want a tutti frutti. I'll have a cherry, he says. Lonnie comes back, peeling the sticky paper from his cherry bullet. It's a bright pink color. The truck drives away. Guess how much this cost, Lonnie says, sitting beside me on the grass. 60 cents. It's a good thing you didn't want one. He licks his fingers and then the ice stick. You want a bite? He holds it out toward me. Lonnie is so patient and so sweet. It's just too bad he's such a nerd. I take a bite of his cherry bullet. Good, huh? Lonnie says. He watches me eat for a second, then takes a bite himself. He breaks the bullet in half and eats it in a couple of huge bites. A little pink juice runs down his chin. What are you waiting for? He asks. I nod toward the mailbox. It's Memorial Day, Lonnie says. The mail doesn't come. He stands up and pulls the trowel out of the ground. I think of King Arthur. There's no mail for anyone today, Lonnie says, no matter how long you wait. He hands me his two bullet sticks and returns to his geraniums. I have this feeling, holding the stained wooden sticks, that I will keep them for a long, long time and come across them one day and remember this moment incorrectly. After After the coals in the barbecue have melted into powder, the fireflies come out. They hesitate in the air, as if stunned by dusk. Lonnie and my mother are sitting beside the now clean pool, and I am sitting on the other side of the natural forsythia fence that is planted around it, watching the bats swoop from tree to tree, feeling the darkness clot all around me. I can hear Lonnie and my mother talking, but I can't make out what they're saying. I love this time of day. Early evening, early summer. It makes me want to cry. We always had a barbecue on Memorial Day with my father, and my mother cooked this year's hamburgers on her new barbecue, which Lonnie bought her for Mother's Day. She's old enough to be his mother, but she isn't, I would have said, if I talked. She cooked them in the same dumb, cheerful way she cooked last year's. She has no sense of sanctity or ritual. She would give Lonnie my father's clothes if my father had left any behind to give. My mother walks toward me with the hose, then past me toward her garden to spray the pea plants. "Okay," she yells to Lonnie, who stands by the spigot. He turns the knob and then goes inside. The light in the kitchen snaps on. My mother stands with one hand on her hip, the other raising and lowering the hose, throwing large fans of water over the garden. She used to bathe me every night, and I think of the peas hanging in their green skins, dripping. I lie with one ear on the cool grass, and I can hear the water drumming into the garden. It makes me sleepy. Then I hear it stop, and I look up to see my mother walking toward me, the skin on her bare legs and arms glowing. She sits down beside me, and for a while, she says nothing. I pretend I'm asleep on the ground, although I know she knows I'm awake. Then, she starts to talk, as I knew she would. My mother says, "You are breaking my heart." She says it as if it were literally true, as if her heart were actually breaking. "I just want you to know that," she says. "You're old enough to know that you are breaking my heart." I sit up. I look at my mother's chest, as if I could see her heart breaking. She has on a polo shirt with a little blue whale on her left breast. I'm afraid to look at her face. We sit like that for a while, and darkness grows around us. When I open my mouth to speak, my mother uncoils her arm from her side and covers my mouth with her hand. I look at her. "Wait," she says. "Don't say anything yet." I can feel her flesh against my lips. Her wrist smells of chlorine. The fireflies, lighting all around us, make me dizzy.
Memorial Day by Peter Cameron, performed for us by Noah Galvin. The story appeared in The New Yorker in 1983. Peter Cameron went on to write, "Someday This Pain Will Be Useful to You," and other books. I'm David Remnick. Recently, staff writer Peter Hessler went to a dance club in China as that country continues to reopen, and we'll find out what that was like next week. It's The New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.